Hello and welcome back to Your Politics Show here on Mix 92.6 FM. This is Your Politics Show because we talk about national and local issues, but the main thrust of the conversation is directed by your questions that you send in all through the month, and we put them to the local politicians. We try to get the best answers and help with local issues. So do remember, before we get into the show, that you can email in at any time if you have any questions to put to our Labour, Liberal Democrat or Conservative MPs, and we will answer them through our social media or through our emails. Today we are talking to Bim Afalami, the local MP for Harpenden and Hitchin. Welcome back to the show. Now, we're going to start off with what the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has said is the priority of the government right now, and he has been working on passing through legislation to stop the boats crossing the channel. You're now trying to get this through Parliament. Could you explain to us what this legislation is and if you will be supporting it?
What the legislation does is it makes it just a hell of a lot harder for people to come through safe countries such as France or Italy or Germany or Greece. Yeah, these are not war-torn countries. Come through safe countries like that and come to Britain illegally. So there are a series of measures that do that. Some are practical, some are legal. For example, the legal one is it is an offence to do that thing in and of itself, to come across illegally in a boat. On arrival, you would have committed an offence. But there are also practical things. So we're improving, getting rid of the asylum backlogs. We're getting rid of that. We're putting more money and more people into dealing with that so that if people want to come here legally, it can be processed faster. But ultimately, it is not, when people talk about compassion, it is not compassionate to allow people smugglers to get rich trafficking people across an incredibly dangerous and icy cold sea crossing with a sort of fanciful promises of a better life. So it's important that we clamp down on this. People die crossing the channel quite regularly. Let's not encourage this. Let's try and stamp it out as best we can. And this bill, alongside lots of other things, I think it's important to be honest and say one piece of legislation is almost never going to be the solving of any problem. But this bill can help deal with this problem, I think.
I do want to take part some of the things that you've said there. And we're going to spend a little bit of time on this because obviously this is big legislation. This is one of your five key promises for, you know, the rest of kind of Rishi Sunak's premiership, you know, until the next general election. Unless there's new ideas, obviously, that come into place. But looking at the word, you know, asylum seeker, looking at the specific legislation from the UN Convention, the legislation itself, which the UK is a signatory to, it says that it doesn't matter how an asylum seeker chooses how they get into the country or how they arrive. It doesn't matter in terms of where they select to go. So why is it that you're referring to these people crossing illegally when the legislation says that they're not coming here illegally?
Well, that's not quite what it says. What it says is that if you are a genuine asylum seeker, then obviously you aren't coming illegally. But the point is that we've got to try and identify who is genuine. And you know why this is difficult, because as I said initially, if people are coming from, for example, Afghanistan or wherever, but they're coming through safe countries where they could claim asylum, one has to question whether they are genuine asylum seekers. Some may be, but you've got to understand, you've got to question, well, if you've come through a safe country where you could claim asylum, why are you not claiming asylum there? Is it possible that you're actually not necessarily an asylum seeker, but you may just be wanting to move to the UK for other reasons, which, you know, I don't have a problem with it at all. It's what my parents did, but I think they should do it according to the rules that we have. So I think that that's the difficulty with this issue.
On that point, again, you know, you're talking there of people choosing the country that they go to. And just to reiterate the point, the legislation says it doesn't matter. But also looking at the numbers
More than 80% of people who apply for asylum in this country get it. So it seems like it's a minority issue, that the minority of people using these routes to come here, most of them are genuine people. So it doesn't seem to be that most of these are economic migrants at all. Does it seem fair to kind of cope most of these people in that group when in fact the majority are law-abiding? In fact, they're some of the most vulnerable people in the world.
Well, part of the reason why our rates are at 80%, and that's 80% of people who apply for asylum get it, is I think what you've said. Part of the reason why that is the case, if you compare us to other European countries, it's much higher than most of them, for example, like Germany or France, is that the reason for this is that because our system hasn't been effective enough, by the time somebody's claim is determined, quite often it's been so long that it would seem unjust to the court to throw them out of the country. And in addition, even when somebody isn't a legitimate asylum seeker, if the system has not worked properly enough so that we don't even know where this person has come from, partly because maybe they've destroyed their documents or because of incompetence on the British end, then it's impossible for the court to say that we should remove them because we wouldn't know where to remove them to. So the question about whether they're genuine or not is actually quite complicated. And I think that, and I've said implicitly, but now I'll say explicitly, we need to have a much more effective processing system for people when they come here. Because unless we do that, then none of this is really going to work.
Now, talking of legal things, and you know, we've discussed there that these people, if they are genuine asylum seekers, they're not breaking the law. But Helen O'Nions is Associate Professor of Law at Notting Trent University, and she actually thinks that the government's new legislation is breaking the law. She says it does not merely push the boundaries, it rides roughshod over domestic law, common law, and the UK's international human rights obligations. This is something also that Suella Baferman herself has said, that she can't commit to saying whether the legislation will meet the international agreements that Britain has. So do you think that this is breaking international law? And if so, why is it all right for the government to break the law just to get through what it wants?
So it's important that I don't stray out of my area of expertise. I was a lawyer, but I wasn't an international public law specialist at all. So, you know, whether I think something's breaking international law or not is neither here nor there. I think that the point is this. International law is not like domestic criminal law. It's not like trying somebody for murder, right? International law is an incredibly movable feast that is frankly very political. There are countries in Europe, such as Italy, which have already come out and said publicly that they think that what we're doing is perfectly within the remit of the ECHR. Now, I'm not saying that they are correct. What I am saying is that there's a margin of appreciation here where you just got to figure out what the rights, what the court might do. And, you know, it isn't really any single government, any politician, our priority has to be the people of this country. And yes, international law matters, and it's very, very important to factor into our decision making, but it is quite speculative, and ultimately it will have to get tested at the European Court, and only then will we really understand whether the European Court regards it as within the rules or not. And it's vague, and how we determine the law is really going to be a question over the coming months and years as to how this plays out practically.
One final question before we move on to the other matters for this week. People have pointed out that Britain at the moment, apart from Ukrainians and some Afghanistanis, has no safe routes for people to apply. There's no ability for people to apply offshore, which is what the UK law is, that you have to be onshore to be able to apply for asylum. France has, for many years, since the Brexit vote, has said they would open a safe route on their land for people to apply in Calais or other areas. You know, you've talked there of concern for refugees, and that this is, you know, based on empathy and wanting to get rid of gangs. But surely that would cut the need for gangs at all if they could apply safely off UK land in France or other countries. Why isn't that an option, Bim?
Well, there is a summit with the President of France taking place maybe by the time this has come out, and very, very soon. And I know that this will be on the agenda. So let's see what results from that. It obviously makes sense to partner with neighboring countries like France, but bearing in mind the sort of rapprochement with France is very recent. You know, until we sorted out the Northern Ireland Protocol, you know, France was not playing ball. We haven't had a summit, a sort of bilateral summit with France for over 5 years. So hopefully this will help the cooperation, because obviously cooperation is what you need, whether it be around this sort of so-called safe route or other things.
Let's turn our attention to, in recent weeks, we've seen some supermarkets rationing certain foods due to shortages. The situation has been explained due to weather issues on the continent. However, British farmers have said it's been made worse by the government not giving local growers enough support. And evidence shows that Europe is not having similar levels of problems, but they are having some problems. Bim, what is the government now doing to rectify some of these issues?
The government can't sort out Sainsbury's supply chain, right? For example, that isn't the government's place. Sainsbury's run their business. But the broader issue is that this is mostly about sort of energy prices and greenhouses. For example, in the case of tomatoes, you may think that's ridiculous, but it's true. It is also about the fact that we've just coming out of COVID. I know it seems like a long time ago, but we're only getting back to normal in terms of supply chains everywhere. So certain foodstuffs, if you're having to get them from very, very far away, it is harder and more expensive than it was in the past. And it's happening all over the world. The difference with mainland Europe is because they're in mainland Europe, they don't have this thing called the English Channel. So distribution between European countries is much easier for that reason. It's not actually about being in the European Union. It's about being with a land border that's easy to cross rather than a sea one. That's really what this is about.
Also, this month, you've been working in Westminster, as always, but you've secured a Westminster Hall debate on the future of the UK Constitution. Why did you feel that this was such an important issue to debate?
Well, partly because it's not debated enough in public. There are lots of discussions that happen in back rooms about how we're going to deal with this or how we're going to deal with that, and, you know, how local government should operate, either in Hertfordshire or London, or what should the powers of the Mayor of London be to expand the ultra-low emission zone out to the suburbs? All of these things are really about devolution of power. What power's held locally? What power's held centrally in Westminster? And so I thought it was important to do a debate on this subject. It got a lot of attention, got a lot of comment, and it was worthwhile.
This month as well, you wrote about AI technology. You said, ignore the Luddites, and that effective public policy can ensure that emerging technologies improve productivity and working conditions, not replace workers. How can you be so sure on this, Bim? And what kind of legislation do you think should be brought in to oversee this change in the makeup of the economy?
If anybody who's listening to this has used ChatGPT, which is online, you can find it.
Yeah.
They will know just how, and if they haven't used it, they should. Go and find it online, very easy, ChatGPT. They will know just what a remarkable tool it is. And it's just one little snippet of a huge amount that has been changing in terms of artificial intelligence. What this really means is machine learning, machines combing through millions of bits of data to get answers to questions, and to help human beings do things more effectively and more efficiently. And so it will, broadly speaking, benefit the economy and benefit people's lives, because it will mean things will be able to be done faster, more accurately, and more easily than they currently are. That can only benefit the economy. There are people whenever you get these technological changes, they say, oh, what about the jobs of so-and-so or so-and-so? I'll give you an example. When electronic cash points came in, people were really scared about people who work for banks. They said, oh, there'll be nobody in banks, because you used to have to go into a bank to a cashier, and that was how you used to get your cash. And of course, all that happened was the people who used to be behind a desk and the cashier, now you might go into a bank and you've got one or two. The people are now out, they're talking to you about loans, they're talking about insurance, they're helping advise you on savings. And so things just work. You still need people in the bank. And I just think that artificial intelligence will be an advance that people will be scared of. And then they'll work out that their lives are better, their businesses make more money than they did before.
You've also been discussing one of your ideas to solve housing shortage issues while preserving the environment. You've discussed your belief in brownfield development first. Could you tell us more about this idea?
There are two ways of building houses. You either build them on green fields, or you build them on existing sites where things already are, where there are buildings already that need to be knocked down, demolished, or converted. It is plainly obvious to me that, seeing as we live on an island and we're one of the most densely populated countries in Europe, we really need to be developing our brownfield sites, which are the sites where things are already built, much more than we are. You go to any high street, even in our area, let alone in poorer parts of the country, you will see empty shops, empty space, with nobody doing anything to it. And then they'll be putting up a new housing development on green fields on the outside of the town. Now, for me, we need to be prioritizing the brownfield, making it easier to redevelop. I think there are tax changes we can make in relation to that, for example. You could just have no 0% VAT on it, and that would give you a 20% discount on what you have today. If we did that, that would make a huge difference to protecting our green spaces, which I think most people want to do, myself included.
Also this month, you've been on a trip to Washington. Tell us what you learned whilst you're in the USA.
I was on a trip with an organization called the Coalition for Global Prosperity. Now, that sounds very grand. What it basically does is it works on diplomacy, defense, and development issues. And went along with this delegation. We met lots of senators, congressmen, went to the White House, saw senior administration officials. Didn't see the president. He was around, but we didn't get a meeting with him. But we did speak to lots of people who worked around him. I learned three key things. One is that we are a development superpower in terms of our aid we give to the developing world, and we need to continue with that. The second is the partnership on Ukraine couldn't be stronger between the US and the UK. But we need to work much more closely with the World Bank to get more money into the Ukraine, because it's not just their defense that we need, it's also just keeping their society and economy functional. And the third is that the United States is getting serious about climate action, you know, working to improve the economy. Working to improve the climate and the economy at the same time, forgive me. So that is something that under the Trump presidency, I think it's fair to say we didn't see. They were the three big things.
Now, turning our attention to local issues. This month, you had a meeting with the local county council on the issue of improving rural transport. What were some of the ideas discussed, and has there been any commitments from this meeting?
We discussed a lot of things. Broadly, we looked at bus services in rural areas and how we need to improve those fast. Secondly, we talked about there's some highways issues to do with dangerous roads where it's not very easy for people to walk. And so what they've committed to do in both of these instances is bring the right people from the council to physically come and see a lot of these issues, whether it be buses, rural buses, or indeed dangerous roads, so that once I'm walking the site with them, we can get some actions. I think sometimes when you send emails, it doesn't quite get you there.
Now, this brings us nicely on to a issue for the area. The Department for Transport has shown that Hertfordshire County has had a 56.5% reduction in bus mileage since 2017. This is the highest in England. With the goal of tackling climate change, something that you've talked about many times, Bim, you're a proud kind of champion of that, and creating a greener economy, surely this is a worrying step backwards in your area.
It's not good. I think a big part of that is COVID, to be honest. And we've got to get those numbers back up. There's no doubt. It's not even just about the environment. It's about people who don't have cars, whether they be through lack of money or just through being elderly, feeling safe to drive. Because unless we get buses that are properly networked, then people are left in their homes alone, and that hurts their mental health, well-being, and you know, diminishes the value, or diminishes the positive nature of our society. So we've got to network people with others. Buses are a key way of doing it.
Now, some have asked this question. They've turned the issue on to maybe nationalisation. In Hertfordshire, the County Council already subsidised contracted bus services for up to £4 million. But 95% of bus operators are commercial. With the need to create more rather than less public transport, would it be good to nationalise at least the public transport maybe in the Hertfordshire area till some of these issues are sorted? Because like you said, Bim, there's lots of people, we've had messages from individuals who, you know, they've lost the route to their house. It's very hard for them to get transport. And one lady we chatted to is going blind and she will have to move because there's no bus route for her anymore.
Nationalizing something in and of itself doesn't change anything to do with buses or indeed anything else. Because, so let's just say you nationalize the bus services. Let's just say you could do that. Not saying you could, but say you could. You would still have to pay drivers. You'd still have to get lots more buses. Who's going to pay for that? At the moment, we have private companies who shoulder the burden of that. Yes, there's a subsidy from the County Council in some description, but ultimately the private companies are paying for that. That means taxpayers would have to pay for it. Now, that's okay if the demand is sufficient that it pays for itself, but it probably pay for itself over a very long period of time. Don't forget, the private companies have been there for a long time, so they've already recouped a lot of their costs. So I think you'd probably end up with fewer buses and older ones, or ones that were less environmentally friendly and just not as nice to be in, because the county council is unlikely to be able to afford it. And if we've got extra money, which I think we should prioritise buses, let's make sure that we give it to the private companies on the condition that they provide more service in the areas where we need them.
Let's turn to the community questions. Colin started us off. He's asked, any update on the council's disgraceful parking charges?
In a word, no. They haven't told me anything.
There was a council meeting on that issue, though, Bim. Did they pass that through? Have they, you know, said that it's going to come in?
I haven't heard that it isn't going to come in. So I think it is, but I will double check. They haven't sent me a note, so I will go and check the with the council.
Okay, well, I'm sure Colin will be eagerly awaiting for that, and he can check out your social media to find out the answer for that. James said you contacted the council about the reduction in bin services. Was there any success from you talking with them?
They, as of speaking, time of speaking, they have not changed their mind about bin services. So I'm hoping that they do.
Andrew has asked probably quite a personal question here, but he said, with the Matt Hancock WhatsApp messages being released, are you worried any of your messages might have been sent to the former health minister?
Gosh, good question. No, I don't think so. No, I mean, I'm talking about, I'm complaining about tears that we were put in. No, I think I'm okay.
Unfortunately, at this point of the interview, we lost connection with Bim due to technological issues, and he wasn't able to complete the usual half an hour that we give to all of our MPs for fairness. So Bim will be returning very soon to answer your questions, and we can only apologise that this interview was slightly shorter than usual.